This week on Writers, Inc.
It's that sentence that you want to convey in one sentence. You know, in your first paragraph, you want to say the who, why, what, where, when of the story. And although a novel is 90 to 100,000 words, and, you know, a new story is 600 words max, probably, you are still trying to, you still need that hook.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories. All have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, it's Christine Daigle.
I'm Jenna Brown.
I'm Kevin Tomlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. So we were talking real quick before we started. Like, I've got this pretty crazy setup when I do podcasts and TV and stuff now. So, like, when I have to start, I have to, like, run around my office. I've got electric blinds I've got to close. I've got lights I've got to turn on. Like, all these different things. I had one yesterday, and this never happened to me before. But, like, I use an iPhone for my camera. And I usually just log into all this stuff maybe a minute or two before I need to start. You know, like, I've got it down pretty quick. But I turn everything on, and, like, my camera's not working. And, like, the camera is, like, mounted with a suction cup on a TV in front of me, so I can't actually see the display. So I took it out of there, and I look at it, and it said iPhone updating. Like, it was updating with the latest software. And then it failed with the update. So, like, I had to restore it to factory settings and stuff and put it back on there. So, like, I Kevin, I know you use an iPhone. Have you ever run into that? Like, is there a way to keep it from, cause, like, I don't need it to update it at all. I need the camera. That's it.
You can turn off automated updates. I kind of pretty regularly check this and look for updates, cause you never know what it might be, but I actually have a dedicated iPhone now for my camera, because
that's what I'm doing
free.
But that's the problem, though. Like, I don't, you know, like, my regular phone, I see the updates happen all the time. I'm on top of that, but, like, this one is literally just stuck to the wall in front of me, and I don't look at it.
You could put it in airplane mode. I think the only thing that you need for a continuity camera is to turn on the Bluetooth, so you could probably shut everything else off.
I gotta try it. I don't want to get surprised like that again. Because that was awkward. Like, it took me a good 20 minutes before I could actually jump on the call. And, like, she was super gracious. And she's like, I'll be here. And, like, I'm scrambling behind the scenes trying to get it all done. And,
they're used to technical glitches like that, though. You're fine.
Not from me, man. I'm a perfectionist.
Me too, but...
I don't glitch.
So right now, instead of the utility room I'm usually in, I'm in a bedroom. You can't tell by looking because I've got it all set up. But, like, I've gotten this whole setup streamlined down to, like, I could shove it all in a bag and carry it anywhere at this point. I miss having my permanent setup, though. I miss my office. And it'll be a few months.
We don't know where Kevin could be at any given point in time.
This might not even be me you're looking at on the screen.
We've long wondered that.
Could be a deep fake.
It would answer a lot of questions. All right. What is in the news?
In the news, Simon & Schuster adds 6,000 titles to the blacklist. Simon & Schuster has added more than 6,000 backlist titles to the blacklist, a platform used by film and TV professionals to discover material for adaptation. The move makes thousands of Simon & Schuster books searchable by producers, studios, and executives, making it easier for Hollywood to find books that could become movies or TV series. The partnership is a part of a growing trend of publishers treating their backlists as valuable intellectual property libraries, creating new pathways for authors' older books to be discovered and adapted for the screen.
I'm still trying to figure this out because I've got a lot of friends in Hollywood, a lot of people that work in the industry, and I have yet to find somebody who actually uses the blacklist for this from a professional level.
Yeah.
And they may be out there, but, like, I've literally been asking that question because it's coming up so much. I'm curious about it. Like, anybody that I know, like, even, you know, if they're a producer, they're going to just jump on Google, you know, I need a book that about this. And, you know, like, that's going to give them the widest net.
I had to pull mine down from the blacklist because they told me that it can only be unpublished work. So I had to take mine down.
That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, I didn't think it made sense either. I don't know. exactly what happened there, but I had a whole deal where I was trying to get them, because you can get them to do like a, you pay like $100 and they'll do like an in-depth review of it or rate it or something like that. I tried to do that. And that's when they came back to tell me that they couldn't do it because I was already published. So
maybe that's
I took
a
them all
different,
down.
Maybe that's like a different program though. Like,
it could be that I misinterpreted something, but they took the book down though. I was fine with leaving it up there, but they're the ones that shut it all down because it was already published. And I don't know if that was a mistake or what. So they were nice about it, but they were kind of blunt.
I wonder about it because when it first came on, I put myself on there because they're like, I'm like, well, more places to be found. So just like, you know, my bio and stuff, right? But not work. But yeah, then it's like you have to, if you have a manuscript, you have to pay like $100. And if you want to get seen, you need at least three. And it seems like, I don't know, they're like making a lot of money. But then Simon & Schuster, I'm sure, I don't know what the deal is there with them having backlists. Like, are they paying?
I gotta think they've got a deal.
Blacklist or has, I don't know. So I was kind of curious about how that was working and who's making money.
Did you guys see the story of that apparently how studios are going to Reddit now and looking for
really
short stories and other ideas
for
films?
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
That I know does happen. I mean, they're looking for buzz, right? They're looking for things people are talking about, which is, you know, they also hit NetGalley, they hit Edelweiss, the other things, just looking to see what's getting reviews before it actually comes out. So that all makes sense. I'm skeptical about this just because I have yet to find somebody in Hollywood that says, "Ooh, I'm going to check the blacklist because I need this," you know. And those people are probably out there, and I just haven't talked to them yet. And you know, blacklist is making money off these listings, off authors, which, you know, is always a
coming and going
cautionary flag.
They make money off the people who submit their stuff, but they also make money off the people who search that database, right?
I do wonder if just having Simon & Schuster will start giving it more traction, though. I mean, that's kind of a big name, so. You know, if suddenly people start hearing like, oh, there's 6,000 more titles on there to look through, they might use it as a resource. I don't know.
Let me save you all some time and money. Just go to kevintomlinson.com/books. You'll find your next big project. It won't cost you a dime.
They most likely gave Simon & Schuster a big discount in order to dump that in there. It's just so that they could use that to get a little street cred.
Yeah.
You know, we've got 6,000 titles from Simon & Schuster in the database now.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, if any of your books go in there from Simon & Schuster, JD, let us know how it works out.
I didn't receive anything from Simon & Schuster, you know, from a communication standpoint. So if they dumped my titles in there, they didn't tell anybody or didn't tell me.
Perfect.
All right. Next up, Elias Thorne is Chatbot's favorite character. Researchers analyzed roughly 20,000 AI-generated stories from major chatbots. One name in particular, Elias Thorne, has become something of an AI folk character. The name is now appearing outside chatbot stories, including on books, websites, and YouTube channels that appear to be AI-generated or AI-assisted.
So, I actually have a very funny story about this. I have a friend who was working, and they were using an AI a checker on applications for, like, they had to do like makeup. They had to make up something about a character for this job that they were looking for a freelancer for. And the amount she could tell by the end, like, who used AI just based on the names that showed up. And Elias Thorne is one of them that showed up a lot. Lena showed up a lot. Marlo showed up. Like, it was, and it would just come in these huge clusters as people were, you know, just because it was like a Google Doc on LinkedIn. And so just huge clusters of, and these names just over and over and over again. So I think that's pretty funny.
The funniest thing that I've seen also is like, with professors putting like white text at the bottom of an assignment, like if you used a chat bot, name the company, you know, Big Burn. And so when you copy and paste that into ChatGPT, like all these companies are named Big Burns when they're turning in assignments, which is hilarious. Yeah.
Well, it's really interesting though, just how it chooses, like, and it just, you know, because I'm assuming that a lot of these wasn't just like US, and they were using multiple chatbots. So it's like these names just keep coming up. And if it's a predictive machine, it's just, it's very fascinating that they
Elias
would just come
Thorne.
Up
with
the
it's
same
not a good
name.
day to be named Elias, I guess, like that. Yeah.
Well, I mean, if you think it through, they're all pulling from the exact same data, right? It doesn't matter how many people are using it. They're all hitting that same database over and over again. So they're going to have the same names, the same places, the same storylines, the same story structure, probably in a lot of ways. That's kind of funny.
I am not like super familiar with AI, and I don't know if you guys would know this or not, but if like I used an AI, like an LL, like Claude or something, and then you used it with like the same, we are applying for the same job and put the same prompts in there. Does it influence, like if 1,000 people use that same prompt, does it like influence what comes up for the next 1,000 people?
They say no, you know, like your chats are private, their chats are private, and the two things don't cross. So that's the line. That's what they're putting out there. I don't know. But I mean, if you read into this, what's happening is the data that it's giving you to put into yours, it's pulling from the same place that, you know, it's using to inform the answer of the next person after that. So it's giving four or five people the same answer to the same question.
Right. Yeah. It's supposed to be predictive, right? Like what's the most likely name and scenario. So I wonder if you go back and analyze the data set that it trained on, if there's a whole bunch of people in there named Elias who work in a lighthouse. Is that a common trope? I don't know.
Doesn't that read like it trained primarily on like cozy romance books though? Because
maybe
all that clicked together. I'm like, oh, that sounds like a cozy romance.
Elias Thorne. I mean, romance is one of those ones that's like predominantly for free on the internet, right? Like on KDP and stuff. So that kind of makes sense. But yeah, I don't know. Maybe I don't read enough cozy romance. Like Elias doesn't seem like a very common name I've come across.
Yeah, but I mean, we do this too, right? Like Kevin, I can guarantee you've got certain names you hit way more often than other names as character names, right?
I have to check like myself.
We all do it. Like I used the name Bernie in like three different books and didn't even realize I was doing it, you know, until it started cropping up with, you know, reader comments and stuff.
I have the name Roland shows up in my work a lot, I've noticed. It's some version of it. It'll be spelled different, but it's the same name. So I've had to catch myself on that a few times. I don't know why. I'm enamored with the name Roland. I don't know why.
I know why.
Final story. Why publishing more content is making your SEO worse. The article argues that the old SEO strategy of publishing as much content as possible no longer works in an AI-driven search environment. Instead of rewarding sheer volume, AI search systems increasingly reward clear expertise and authoritative content. AI search tools don't evaluate websites the way traditional search engines did. They often pull small chunks of information rather than entire pages. So having dozens of similar articles can actually dilute your authority instead of strengthening it. The author warns that publishing lots of overlapping content can create semantic dilution, where multiple pages compete with each other for the same topic. Rather than helping rankings, this can confuse AI systems about which page is the definitive source. Well, screw us all then.
I mean, I don't know how else to do it. You know,
right? We've spent decades. I'm supposed to be a subject matter expert writing on this topic, on which I am a subject matter expert. And now you're telling me that if I wrote too much about it, then I won't show up in search results anymore. Well, whoop-a-dee-doo. Well,
the AI wants you to take all of that data and consolidate it into one document to make its job easier.
Yeah.
That's all it's asking.
Yeah, that's all.
Robots, they're lazy, just like us.
Screw integrity or any actual writing skill. Let's cram every word we can into one document.
Welcome to AI.
Welcome to
AI. I know.
Google is dead. Welcome to your AI search engine.
Yeah.
Yep.
I think, though, that a lot of us out here may be okay in this. I think, for one, because this is a thing and it's sort of a known issue, I'm betting somebody's trying to figure out how to fix that as a problem, because that can't work. You know, you can't penalize somebody for being, you know, prolific on a topic.
It needs to be weighted, right? So if you're mentioned in 500 articles on the same topic, then like that in itself should create a weighting that just puts you higher than the person that was only mentioned 400 times.
So just in your SEO somewhere, just put the definitive list of thriller books on your website, and there you go.
I'm just going to put the text world's best author everywhere and let AI pick that up. There world's best author. These books make give sure, you...
Make sure the story is written by Elias Thorne.
Yes.
Elias Thorne says... That's that's going to be in my blurbs and reviews. Best writer I've ever seen, Elias Thorne, librarian.
Wonderful to read in a lighthouse. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
That's all the news.
Okay, JD, who's up this week?
This week we've got Sarah Vaughan coming on. Sarah's a Sunday Times and international best-selling author of several novels. She also spent 15 years as a journalist, including 11 years with The Guardian as a political correspondent and news reporter. Her latest novel is called Based on a True Story. It's about an author who will do anything to protect the secrets she's kept from her family for more than 50 years. Here she is, Sarah Vaughan.
Okay, Sarah, welcome to the show. We're happy to have you on.
Lovely to be here.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about your newest book, which is called Based on a True Story, and I am excited to dig into that. But before we get there, we always like to start at the beginning. How did you get started in writing and publishing? What's your origin story?
Okay, so when I was a little girl, I used to write stories, and in fact, at the age of 10, I became Devon Young Writer of the Year, which is my sort of local area. And it was a prize that gave me £75 in cash and £50 in book vouchers, which in the day was quite 1983. It's quite a lot of money when you're young. So I loved writing, but I as I became a teenager and the school system in the UK means that you do public exams at 16 and then at 18 and go to university, and it's all quite pressurized. I kind of can remember feeling like my imagination had disappeared, but I read English at Oxford, so I was, you know, I had 3 years of reading books in this sort of really magical place. And while I was there, I got into student journalism, and I think it never occurred to me that at that stage that I could be an author. For my degree, you didn't have to read anything after 1832, and so I was reading a lot of literary fiction by, you know, the contemporary stuff I was reading was literary fiction by people like, you know, Martin Amis and Graham Swift and Ian McEwan. So I kind of thought that books were written largely by dead white men. You know, I think I wrote about Virginia Woolf for my dissertation. That was seen as quite modern. And so it did not occur to me at all I could write a book. I can remember Zadie Smith getting her book deal for White Teeth. I think she's a couple of years younger than me, as we graduated, you know, in the mid 90s or whatever. And just being absolutely shell-shocked that the idea that anybody my age could possibly write a book. But I did think I knew I wanted to write as a career. So I became a journalist. I did a journalism course. I then spent 2 years at something called the Press Association, which is a news agency, so like Reuters or AFP, which was actually brilliant, a brilliant education into being thrown into writing quickly, not writing like a student journalist, you know, doing news stories, reacting to quite big news stories that happened, because we were often the first on the scene. And then I got poached by the Guardian newspaper, and I spent 11 years there as a news reporter, and then latterly as a political correspondent. Sorry, that's a long story. So I still wasn't writing fiction at all. I was busying lots of news. The politics bit was really important, because that later came into my novels. After I had my second baby, I had a pregnancy complication that meant that I couldn't walk. Mm. And I took voluntary redundancy because it seemed the only possible solution. I had two small children. I had a husband who was working as a hospital doctor. We'd moved, so I couldn't commute. You know, with this back issue. And so I just took the money. And at that time, the idea was that I would freelance as a journalist. And this was sort of, by this stage, it was about 2010. And the world had really changed because this thing called the internet had come along. And it meant that it was really difficult to get published, because newspapers kind of could get the stuff much cheaper, you know. And also I was, you know, a mum at home with two small children. I couldn't do the sort of journalism that I had done before. So I started writing a book. And I stood up at my 40th birthday party, but I turned 40 the week that my youngest started school. And I'd worked out that I had enough money to spend a year trying to get this book written. But somebody said to me, what are you going to do, you know, now you're 40? And I said, I'm going to write a book and get it published within a year. So having kind of announced this, I kind of then had to be accountable and I had to do it. And I did. Within 13 months, I'd sold my book in a six-figure preempt, and it sold, I think, to 9 countries. And then I was off at the age of 40 in a different career. So I'm very lucky. I'm not somebody who has, unfinished manuscripts in my book, in my desk drawer. I hadn't spent, you know, decades trying to get books written and failing. I contacted my now agent when I'd written 28,000 words and told her I knew exactly where it was going, and I knew how to meet a deadline because I was a journalist. But I do think that I had written every day since the age of 18, really, because I'd done an English degree, then I'd been a journalist. And so I think that I had learned about the discipline of writing through doing that.
Yeah.
Very long background there.
Yeah, no, but yeah, I can't remember who said, you know, you need to write 1 million words. And
I'm sure I have.
Yeah. I think you have as a journalist, right? That's seems like there are quite a few authors come from the background, and I think you learn discipline, writing, you know, under a time crunch, writing under pressure, and having to have it good enough to go out, right? Which is, you can't.
Yeah, exactly.
You can't tinker. Yeah,
exactly. I mean, I think that's So just to precede my long story there, I basically had 15 years as a journalist, well, student journalism. Started in a staff job, I think. I know, I started, just turned 23. And then I kind of, and then I suppose had a couple of years off the babies. But, you know, so 15 years in journalism altogether. And I think it teaches you to meet a deadline, to write to length. It teaches you things like research, you know, and absolutely critically, on my journalism course, I remember we were told, you know, if you went to a pub and somebody said, what's the story? And you've got a new story. It's that sentence that you want to convey in one sentence. You know, in your first paragraph, you want to say the who, why, what, where, when of the story. And although a novel is 90 to 100,000 words, and, you know, a new story is 600 words max, probably, you are still trying to, you still need that hook, especially with sort of genre fiction. You still need that hook, and you still want to capture the reader's attention really quickly with this. And you still need that sense of propulsion. You still need the why. I was thinking the prologue of my new book starts with a body found on a beach. So immediately, and you don't know whose the body is, and you don't know how they got there or what the relationship is with the person who's found them or anything. So immediately you've got, the only fact you have is that there is a body on a beach. And effectively the next 90,000 words are all about discovering whose this is, how did they get there, why did they get there, you know, where's everybody else? So you're still answering the same what if questions or why question or how question, but you're just doing it over the length of a book.
Yeah, that's right. And I know the advice is get your tagline or your elevator pitch and pitch it to friends and see how they react to it before you write it. Because if people are like, you know, that's probably not the hook you want to spend a year writing if people aren't excited about that book, right?
Although it sometimes takes me longer to hone down the elevator pitch. You know, I don't have it necessarily just as before I start. I work out some of it while I'm doing the actual writing.
Yeah, my elevator pitch never seems to stay the same. I'm like, here, it's this. And then by the end, you're like, it started there. And I don't know, we were going to California and ended up in Florida, but I don't know, that's fine. So that's great. And then, so you were doing political correspondence, which teaches a lot of like research. And do you interview people for your book still? Because that's something I've always been kind of envious, people who have sources and can talk to people about that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I basically had a stint as a trainee being a parliamentary reporter, which is sort of reporting on debates and not the chatting to politicians so much, but just observing the sort of the way in which politics evolves in debates and things. And then I had a stint at the end of the last millennium, actually, when a colleague was on maternity leave, and then when she had her second baby, I kind of got the full-time job. So I kind of did about 4 years altogether in the lobby. And it was at a time when Tony Blair was there. And so but, you know, also David Cameron was sort of coming up and was a contract because he was a more junior, MP at that time and things. So it was a really interesting insight. But talking about, sorry, your question about research. Yes, I mean, I think I find the research a really rewarding part of writing a book. I think I find it slightly easier because it's back to being a journalist, and I'm almost wondering whether I should be writing stuff that's very based on fact, because, for instance, with Anatomy of a Scandal, which is, I suppose, is the book that people are best known, would know me for, and a book called Reputation, which is the book before this one, they are both set in Westminster and they both involve court cases. So I witnessed, or I shadowed, a barrister in a rape trial and a murder trial. I interviewed detectives, so all of that sort of grounds on the research stuff is very like the stuff I would have done as a journalist. For Little Disasters, which is in between the two and has been a TV show as well, that involved lots of talking to paediatricians, to doctors, to obstetrician, you know, doing some sort of medical research. For this one, I did less research in that respect. I did quite a lot of looking on Instagram and Rightmove to sort of get colour and details like that. But I did interview, for instance, a woman who helped people who've been victims of gambling addictions. And I interviewed someone at the bank. And I also interviewed my retired detective who helps me with my books. So, yeah, there is still research. It fascinates me that people are willing to give up their time. People enjoy talking about their jobs and they're willing to give up their time talking to you. I find that really fascinating. So, people are very generous with their time. And I like to ground my work in research. I think it gives me a confidence, that I'm writing something decent.
I think that's something with, newer writers or even writers who have been writing for a while. I always struggle with, like, how do I connect with these people? I'm just curious, how do you, when you want to interview someone, do you just cold email or how do you?
Yeah, it's a lot easier now that the net's come along because you can get people's contact details so much more easily. As a very baby journalist, you would be going through directory inquiries for instance, Anatomy of a Scandal, if I give that as an example. So when I started Anatomy of a Scandal, if people don't know it, has no reason why you should. It's about a Tory MP who's accused of raping a parliamentary researcher with whom he's had an affair and lived in the House of Commons. But a lot of it is told through the viewpoint of a barrister. And I didn't know anybody in this world at all. I mean, my dad's a solicitor, but I didn't know anybody working in the bar. So I contacted the Bar Association and I said, I would like to shadow a female barrister, ideally around 40, who specialises in prosecuting sexual offence cases. And I was put in touch with a junior sort of representative, I think. And she said, oh, there's somebody in my chambers who's about to do a big rape trial. Would you like to follow her? And it was just gold dust because this Casey then became this incredible, she's become a friend, she became this source for me. My Kate Woodcroft isn't her at all, but she allowed me to, she discussed with me how she would be approaching things, and I went and watched her in trial. But I wouldn't have been able to do that if I hadn't emailed the industry body, the Bar Association. And similarly for Little Disasters, I wanted to talk to a obstetrician, so somebody who delivers babies. And so I contacted the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists and spoke to their press office. And I think once you've had books published, it's easier. You can say, I've written a book called Anatomy of the Scandal, and over here people might have heard of that. So they would go, oh, okay, that's the one on Netflix. Okay, okay, right, we'll talk to you. But without that, I would say, I used to be a journalist on The Guardian for 11 years. And, so I guess so they knew that I wasn't going to be wasting their time.
Yeah.
But I think you could say anyway, I'm writing a novel I'm a writer, I'm writing about this, want to make sure that I get my facts straight. And equally, I spoke to a paediatrician. I spoke to social workers. And my kids joke that I am, and this is a skill I think from journalism, I say to them, you know, people like talking about themselves. People like, you know, people like being charmed. They like opening up about themselves. And we were once on a train back from London to Cambridge, and I was really struggling to find a social worker. I couldn't find a social worker to talk to me about an aspect of the plot for Little Disasters, about safeguarding. And I just started chatting to a woman who was coming back on the train. You know, when you have a table, you know, mm-hmm. and you just, chattering away. And within 30 seconds, I found out she was a social worker. So I then met up with her for a coffee and she helped, you know, and, but you just ask people what they do, you know, you just, and you just say, which, you know, this is just background. I promise I won't quote you, but I'm really concerned to get this. To get this right, to get this accurate, I really want to paint a picture of what this world is like. So yeah, so I have found that if you're just really honest with people and appreciative of them giving up your time, then they should help you, or they might help. I mean, obviously not everybody will.
Yeah, I know, that's good advice. You know, I know some people are just like, I'm not really sure to quite go how about this. So yeah, that's great.
And over here, as I say, I'm very lucky that I have a retired, he's kind of a consultant for crime writers who used to be a detective, and he now writes his own crime fiction. So I know a lot of authors. I just saw Claire Leslie Hall in Broken Country. She'd put in the acknowledgements that she'd asked his help as well. So I know a lot of authors who use him. So I'm sure there are equivalents in the, you know, obviously pay. Yeah. But I'm sure there are equivalents in the US. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, great. Awesome. Thanks for sharing that. So your newest book, based on a true story, and I know you said you had to do less research for it. It's about a famous children's author who is fearing that past secrets may come out at her 70th birthday party. What about this book idea captivated you enough to write it, to be like, this is the one that I'm going to do?
Okay, so this is a bit of a deliberate pivot from my three previous books. Yeah. So this is my sixth novel. First two were kind of women's fiction for the reading group market. Anatomy of a Scandal I wrote out of contract, and I didn't even realise I was writing a crime novel, but you know, it suddenly was obvious that I was writing about a rape trial, so I probably was. But it's a political thriller. And then I wrote another two thrillers, political thrillers, psychological thrillers, or legal thrillers, that are quite dark, I guess. So Anatomy of a Scandal, Little Disasters, which has also just been on TV, was set in a hospital, and Reputation, which again is set in Westminster, in our House of Commons, and in the Old Bailey, it involves a murder trial. So, and that had quite dark themes of sort of stalking and internet harassment, and is really about the difficulty of navigating your way as a woman in public life. So they were all quite dark, and I started another book, which I've since put aside and I'm now doing, but it didn't feel quite the right time to write it, because in that intervening period, Reputation came out in 22, the pandemic had happened. I think our world had been so turned upside down. People were reading in a different way. They were wanting things that were more escapist, that weren't as dark as writing about, you know, women, you know, being stalked. You know, we'd actually had big news stories about a young girl who'd been abducted, and, you know, cut by a policeman, and, you know, all sorts of horrible stuff going on here. And I also felt that I wanted to write something a little bit more escapist, a little bit glossier, a little bit more, the sort of shorthand is a sort of Christie for the Instagram age. I wanted to write something that was a bit of a puzzle that could be resolved, that the reader would start with an event, an inciting incident, and, you know, I wasn't going to be sort of, you know, breaking any rules with this at all, but then they would be pulled through the book trying to answer the question of who's this body, and of course character, I think, is always the most important thing. So it's all about the sort of the layered intricacies of these characters. I tend to write about strong women. Mm-hmm. So Anatomy has got a barrister as a main character, Little Disasters has a paediatrician, and Reputation has a female MP. And I knew I wanted to write, I was quite intrigued about writing about an older woman. So they're all in their late 30s, early 40s, those characters. But Dame Eleanor Kingman, the protagonist here, is 70. And I really wanted that, you know, I thought, why not write about a, you know, a boomer who has smashed through some glass ceilings, and so he's quite ruthless, he's quite prickly, and is successful but has a lot to hide. And I also I wanted to write about the two sort of inspirations. You say, what was it that made me think I want to write this? So I knew I wanted to write something more escapist, a bit glossier. I have written a lot about motherhood. Apart from anatomy, all my books have kind of got mother-daughter relationships in. I've never written about siblings. I was watching Succession, the HBO Succession show. And at the end of season three, there is a bit where there's a sort of tip-trick of the three main siblings, and Kendall admits that he's killed... I'm creating a spoiler here, but I'm sure you've seen it.
Spoilers!
that he killed a waiter in season one. And very briefly, Shiv and Roman, kind of his siblings with whom he's been really antagonistic, come together, and you briefly think, oh my gosh, they're... what could they achieve if they combined? What could they achieve? They could take on their dad, couldn't you? This, and I actually started crying. I thought, this is the emotional heart of the show. This is what the show is all about. They just want to love each other. Obviously, it can't be sustained, because then there wouldn't be a season four, and there'd be no jeopardy at all. But that, at the moment, was what I thought was required. And watching it, I thought, what about if I wrote about three siblings? Obviously, Succession, it's partly about the Murdochs, isn't it? But it's also about Leah. And I wasn't interested in writing a sort of my equivalent of a Logan Roy or a King Lear, but I thought I could make her a woman. So I thought, what about if I make her Daymel and a Kingman? I have three daughters called Jilly, Rachel and Delia, not Cordelia. And I flip it so that my Rachel and Jilly are not like Gonorill and Regan and Leia. They are the dutiful daughters. They've bought into the family firm, really, of the publishing industry. And the youngest one, who's an Instagram influencer, is the tricky, spoiled child who is the most adored, but she is the one who possibly has got the most to resent.
Yeah.
But watching Succession was that, okay, I want to write about this. And then I'd always been intrigued by children's authors, so I'd done a lot of research about that, just kind of knew it anyway. And I just thought, there's a really interesting, there are about four instances of children's authors who, this is sort of golden age of, you know, children's fiction in the last century, but who had presented as these sort of wonderful figures, but actually were
pretty terrible.
Yeah, exactly. So that's what I wanted to explore with that. Sorry, long answer yet again.
No, I love that. And I really like that you're saying you were watching Succession. And what you wanted to write was the emotion that you had. I think that's really important to get. This is the emotional experience I want my readers to feel. And I think, you know, people say, oh, yeah, I was inspired by this and by this. But I think really that's the important piece is, you know, this is kind of the aesthetic of the book where I want my reader to be feeling when they're reading. So I think that's fantastic. I also find it really fascinating when writers write about writers.
It probably feels a bit meta, doesn't it? But there is actually a bit of a trend. I think we were saying this beforehand. I did an event with a writer called Araminta Hall, and she's we share the same agent. In fact, we did an event on my publishing day, and she's written something called Unreliable Narrator. Mm-hmm. And actually, I wanted that title, but I couldn't have it because she'd already thought of it. And I just interviewed Evelyn Clark.
Yeah, we were just talking about that before we got on the show.
And I'd read Yellow Face, so I knew there was a sort of, you know, and we were discussing the plot as well, weren't we? So there is a sort of tradition, I think, of writers writing about writers. But I think that probably in a world in which, I was thinking about this, I mean, particularly I think with your president kind of curating one kind of truth, we're all interested in writing our own fictions and writing our own truths, and Instagrammers fall into that as well, because Delia, my character, is curating a specific image that isn't necessarily, that's her form of writing her own story, so to speak, you know. So I think it is something we're all quite interested in. Even the fact that everybody has access to Instagram or Substack, or, you know, everybody's busy writing their own fiction, aren't they? That's not necessarily reality. So that's maybe that all led into it.
Yeah, I'm not going to hold you to remembering everything you wrote in your book, because I know I certainly don't when it's done. But you did have this one section that I underlined and said she would rather rewrite her past
versus
fiction. And that's what writers try to do, make sense of their life while aiming for a a happy ending or at least a satisfying resolution. Do you feel like that's true of yourself as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So I kind of, at the end of that quote is based on a true story, which is where I had the like, oh my gosh, that's the title.
Yeah.
but made more gripping, more affecting with increased jeopardy. But I do, yes, I've just been asked about that quite a lot. I think so. I think, you know, you're told writing is meant to be therapy, and obviously nobody wants to, you know, it's not a journal, is it?
No.
And I didn't realize, I'm on the record as saying that, so Anatomy of a Scandal, I didn't realise until I finished the first draft that actually I was working through a sexual assault I'd experienced in my early 20s and you know, a few sort of instances that, you know, I would rather forget about. And equally, when I wrote Little Disasters, it wasn't until I got to the end of the first draft. Little Disasters is about it's about motherhood and maternal illness, really. And it's specifically something called a form of postnatal anxiety, which is now called perinatal OCD, not maternal OCD. And it wasn't until I got to the end of it that I thought, actually, I knew I'd experienced it after my second baby, but, you know, actually that's what I'm trying to explore in this book. I'm exploring a mother who is almost gaslighting herself. And that's the experience that I had after having my second child, when I had to give up my job and there were lots of sort of couldn't walk and there were lots of life stresses. So those, I suppose, are two traumas, I suppose you'd say, that I'd gone through in life and that I have worked through, you know, I've monetized effectively in my writing. And I don't feel that I have anything more big to write about or that I'm prepared to write about, I suppose. But yeah, certainly in the act of writing about it, I actually feel I've done something really positive, because particularly with the TV shows of both those books, I've had so many women contacting me and saying, you wrote about something I experienced, and thank you for putting into words, particularly that's for Little Disasters, what I felt. And I've been able to talk to my, you know, I've had people telling, quite a few people telling me, you know, I was able to discuss with my husband what happened due to watching Little Disasters or watching Anatomy of a Scandal, or, you know, you completely captured it. So yeah, I think that I obviously have tried to write about bad things and make sense of them and resolve them. This hasn't got, I mean, I can't create a spoiler, but something that Eleanor does, I just, on the record, I haven't done.
I hope not.
So I'm not trying to work through anything like that. And I love my sister dearly and my mother dearly, and they are really not Eleanor and Delia. My sister, in fact, is the book's dedicated to her, and I made her read it before I sent it out because I didn't want her to feel that I was saying that she was Delia. So that's not the case. But I think that, yeah, there's quite a lot of me in every character. That, I mean, for instance, workplace dynamics, the sense of, you know, older women of an older generation not necessarily throwing the ladder back down for women of a younger generation. Mm-hmm. That's something I experienced working in journalism. I haven't in publishing, but in journalism. And, you know, so I think you cherry pick bits of your life and you kind of fling them into books. Yeah, totally.
Yeah. I hope we're getting better at that, helping other women out too. I think we are. I think the next generation is getting better.
Yeah, although my daughter's 21 and I was recently interviewed by a journalist who had written a column when I'd 15 years ago rung in to a phone in about, can you have it all? And I was kind of really quite bleak about whether you can. And she said, you know, I said, well, I'm really hopeful that our daughters now are going to be able to have it all in a better way. But actually, I'm not convinced.
That is true. Oh, well.
Not
we write books of hope and inspiration where people do.
Oh, yes. Sorry. Yes.
There we go. So, oh my goodness, it's been so wonderful talking to you. And just as we're running out of time, I wanted to ask one last question.
Yeah.
If you could give some advice to newer or aspiring authors right now, what would it be?
So I think the market's quite difficult. And I think established authors are finding that as well. I worry about AI. We all worry about AI. I worry about algorithms limiting what people are seeing or getting access to. But I would say that historically, people have always wanted good stories. You know, if you look back at cavemen writing on walls, and although I worry about the attention span of teens, you know, like I've got children who don't read, mm-hmm. they're scientists instead. They are still engaged when I tell a story. They still tell the stories that their mates have told. They still find stories in different ways, I guess, on social media. I think that as a writer, though, what people are looking for is stories that, sounds naff to say, have heart, but, you know, are stories you feel passionately need to be told, that are different, that have a USB to them. And I also think that, although I've worked really hard on plot and pacing, ultimately what I take away from a book isn't the hook or the interesting midpoint shift, although that will make me read faster. It's the character. So I think all my books, the things that people, and the things that I remember about books, it's not necessarily the denouement even, or the you know, the midpoint twist, or might not be able to tell you much about the book, but I can remember the feel of the book and I can remember the characters. So I think do your work on character, embed your character, understand who these people are, try and have characters who are relatable, even though they necessarily will be flawed. I don't believe in writing likable characters. I think I believed at the start of my career I had to do that, but I think my characters have got increasingly spiky but increasingly understandable and relatable. So I think if you can create characters who live off the page, who think about, who you're concerned about their needs and their wants, who feel fully fleshed, who feel like somebody you might know, and you're going to have to magpie details from other people's lives that you know and fling them in, and perhaps draw on your own trauma, you know, or your own, because we've all got that, your own experiences. If you've got a character that can sing, then I think that's the really important thing. Then if you can have a hook, you know, something that you don't think somebody has written about before, then that's really interesting and grabby. But ultimately, I think it comes down to character.
Okay. So Sarah was a journalist, and she said, as a journalist, you want to hit, you know, the who, where, what, why, when in that first paragraph. But in a novel, she's hitting the why question, like, why did this happen, and leaving it there. I don't know. What do you think?
I mean, you can't answer it all at once in a novel, right? You got to pace it out. It's a very different world. I mean, because typically, you know, when you work as a journalist, you're told, okay, I need 500 words on X. And, you know, you got to be very clear and concise. And if you turn in 600 words, the editor's going to trim it down to those 500 anyway. So you just learn to, you know, to write very fast, very tight. You know, so it's kind of the opposite of writing a novel. But I mean, you touched on like the discipline of working as a journalist, I think, is huge when it comes to writing a novel, because you are held to those deadlines, you are held to those word counts, and you don't miss those. And if you do start missing them, they find somebody else to replace you. Then once you've got a couple of years of that under your belt, writing a novel is cake.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you start like with your novels with like, why did this happen, most often or most of the time? Do you start with
I don't. I mean, I let the characters figure it out, you know, so some event happens to them and then they just, you know, I try to play it out as naturally as I possibly can on paper, you know, thinking, you know, this is how it would play out in real life. This is so, you know, that's how I reflect it there.
Yeah, I guess that's what I'm saying. You're leaving your reader with this question, like, why did this happen?
Well, I guess the why is just sort of honing in on the motivation, which I do think is important in a novel. Like, what feels like you would just be telling the reader, like, what's happening? Whereas if you focus on the why, you're kind of focusing on, you know, those underlying reasons that are pushing the character forward. Mm-hmm. So that makes sense to me to focus on that. You know, the who, what, why, or the who, what, where, and how, like all of that is very tell language. Why is the only one that's sort of.
Yeah.
Not so direct, I guess.
I'm trying to think if I've ever once used that idea, like telling the reader why something happened.
I think it's not telling the reader why. It's like you need the why question, or you.
Yeah,
need
it's like the why is
like, why is this body on the beach?
Yeah.
I just wrote a scene that it's a drive-by shooting. So my point of view character is in the, you know, the area that gets shot up. You know, he has no idea why it was just shot up. He has no idea why these people just came through with guns and this or that. But you know, like, those are the questions in real life that somebody would try to answer. Right. So you just chase that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. The why is kind of the interesting part, right? It's like the psychology and the, you know, the underlying, I think, for the most part, like, yeah, I think like you said, JD, that's kind of what we wonder the most as real people. Why did that happen? Why did they do this?
That's like the exact opposite. You're leaving with this why question. Why did this happen? I think most books start that way. Like, why is this happening? I think sometimes it's like you get the why and then it's like, how did this happen? But I think it's most often why.
How feels like, I don't know, like there's an answer, but why? There's not always a clear answer. I guess that's what makes it kind of interesting because.
That's why you want to read. You figure out why this happened, right? Okay. What else did we learn today, boys and girls? I guess if you want to interview someone, you just go through the association directory. Have you ever done that? Just like, oh, I'm just going to pick up the bar directory and see which lawyer I'd like to talk to today.
I've done things like that.
No, but that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, it's gotten way easier. Like when I was doing this kind of stuff, like there was no internet, so you had to find somebody who knew somebody, everybody's Rolodex was gold, back then. And now like the first thing I do is I just jump on Google and, you can find that person. A lot of times there's a contact page, there's a LinkedIn, or there's whatever, but it's so much easier to track somebody down.
So do you just cold email now if you want to talk to somebody?
I do.
I think people are most of the time, particularly if they're not in like very sexy industries, I think most people are elated to have someone, you want me to talk about what I do for a living? Like, are you, what?
In my early media days, I would sometimes literally just show up at a place and say I had an appointment with somebody, and they'd show me in. I got in trouble a couple of times, but I got some really good interviews.
Oh, Kevin.
That
Don't
reminds me
do that.
back when I used to work in finance, at the very beginning, like they would have us cold call. So like we would basically just cold call wealthy people to try and get them on the phone to put them in touch with a broker. And there were so many little tricks we would do. Like we would say, "Oh, I'm returning his call. He just called me a minute ago. I'm calling him back," just to get past the gatekeepers. So a lot of that kind of stuff came into play too.
Sneaky, sneaky.
Sneaky, very sneaky.
Have you ever gotten a source or approached them in like an interesting or unusual way other than just showing up at their office?
What? We're just gonna throw mine out automatically? That's not fair.
Did you at least bring donuts, Kevin? Like, did you bring them something?
Brought me and my
Oh,
sharp wit.
I see. I did read a thing about how this guy got ahead of the applicant pool because everything's just online and you fill out a form by bringing donuts to the HR office of the place that he was applying with. I think he put his resume like on top of it or a note or something like, I
Oh,
hope
that's
you look at
nice.
my resume. And he got hired. I mean, who knows if that's real? Everything on the internet feels so made up these days. But I thought that was kind of interesting in
You
the
can solve a
digital
lot of
age.
problems with donuts.
You really
You
can.
can. Donuts make everyone happy.
Bring donuts if you're going to surprise a source at their place of employment, I
Don't like
suppose.
having feet? Eat a lot of donuts.
Wow.
I'm just throwing that out there. Some people don't like that.
Anyways, okay.
Kevin.
The other thing
I'm
that
solving problems.
with donuts, speaking of problems, the other thing that I thought that Sarah said that was interesting is, when we talk to authors about like where did you get this idea, and they'll be like, oh, I watched the show and the idea or the plot was interesting and I thought I could twist it like this way. But I thought it was really interesting that she said she was watching Succession and what spoke to her wasn't like the idea or the plot, but the emotion of that. And she was like, well, this is the emotional experience I want to recreate for my reader and what I want them to feel. And I was just like, well, that's what kind of the heart of what we're trying to do. So I don't know. I thought that was interesting. Have you ever had a similar kind of experience?
If I've ever necessarily, I guess, would you think like going with a vibe is doing that? Because I definitely am like, all right, I kind of know a vibe I want to go for, but I don't know if it's specifically emotion. Are vibes emotions?
Like, it's kind of like the aesthetic. And I mean, like, not the way it looks, but the way that it feels to your reader, which might be a vibe or an emotion or something like that.
I mean, that kind of feels like what a lot of tropes are, right? Like, tropes kind of focus in on the emotion.
I'm autistic, so I can't explain emotion. Totally understand vibe, though.
Oh,
I mean, the closest thing I've ever done to that is like when I saw the there's a TV show, I think it's on HBO now, called Newsroom, that Aaron Sorkin did. And if you watch the first episode, you know, like just the first, like even if you don't like the show, just watch the first episode, and the pacing and timing and the dialogue and the way that it all comes together is just so perfect. I've tried to replicate that on paper in a couple of different scenes because it's like snapping your fingers, like, but visually.
But do you can recreate like your own emotion, right? And the experience.
Yeah, but like I don't experience emotions the same way I guess that, you know, somebody else would, and under certain situations, you know, certain things do hit me like on an emotional level, but it just doesn't hit the same way. But I can tap right into it too. Yeah. So like, if, you know, I can pull a memory from when I was, you know, 5 or 6, or like when my mom took our first dog away and stuff like that. Like I can remember that like it just happened.
Yeah.
So interesting, because you do create quite a lot of emotion in your books. I mean, there's like a lot happening that's very, I mean, not that you're writing like tearjerkers. Maybe it's easier in a thriller, but I feel like there are, you know, there's like a lot of emotional layers, like in the relationships that you create with your characters.
I think honestly what it is, like if you talk to somebody who's autistic, we spend so much time mimicking other people. When we actually do experience something emotionally, like I pick it apart and try to figure out like, why did it make me feel that way? Why did I react this way? And I think I look at it under a microscope, and because I do that so much, it just makes it that much easier to put it down on paper later, because I've analyzed it. I've literally created a report for myself.
Yeah.
That's so interesting. Yeah.
And, you know, I think there's always something into like, what was that when Donald Moss talks about in his book? I forget what it's called, but he talks about
the emotional craft of fiction.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
About third level emotion, when it's like, not so on the nose that it actually makes you, as a reader, experience it more. Does that make sense? Like, I know he's talking about like firefighters dashing into a building. We're feeling fear. But they're not feeling fear. They're feeling adrenaline, or like,
well, they might be feeling fear, but that's going to be a very common.
But that's not what you're putting on the page. And then we're like, oh my God, don't go in there. And they're all hyped up to go in there. And there's something I think in writing that differently too than right on the nose that makes you experiencing it deeper.
Well, you can play with it. So like the scene that I was just talking about with this shooting. So I've got a character who's sitting there. The shooting is about to happen. You know, he's having a lot of fun. He's got people laughing around him. They're joking. You know, like, and I'm purposely doing that as a writer. Like I'm making it all very light, very funny, because I know I'm, you know, in a second I'm going to take the reader and jerk them all the way over here to this other side. So I want to make sure that, you know, that ride is as far, you know, it has to hit hard. You know, so if you foreshadow too much, the reader knows that it's coming. And then they prepare for it, and then it doesn't land as hard as it possibly could, you know, versus something that's completely unexpected.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. All right. I guess we'll end it there. Fun stuff. JD, who's up next week?
Next week, we've got Maurice Broaddus coming on. Maurice is a fantasy and horror author, best known for his short fiction. He's published dozens of stories in magazines and book anthologies, including Asimov's Science Fiction, Black Static, and Weird Tales. His latest novel is called A City Dreaming, which has been described as Black Panther meets The Expanse. And it releases on June 30th. So Maurice Broaddus.
Yeah, it's going to be great. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode, and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.